Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back. And it is now or never. And that debt is fraud. We could go through this all the time. And I think that that's one of those things that I believe motivates people. Because usually people start getting active politically when they realize that it's going to impact their wallet. There's all, you know, I'm not a prognosticator, but there's a lot of people that say, if we go under, we're going to lose the value of everything. We'll have pennies on the dollar for our currency, property, and so forth. So, folks, maybe that'll motivate you. Maybe that'll make you start thinking, I think we need to kind of do this where we're in control so that we don't necessarily kill ourselves. We'll be a little more cognizant in, doing it slowly, transitioning instead of falling off the cliff and then good luck where you land. Anywho. It's all about Constitution compliance. If we're not in compliance to the Constitution, actually, if our public servants aren't in compliance to the Constitution, as we just went through the Massachusetts debates, it is our fault. We need to hold them accountable. They take an oath, and we actually have teeth in that oath and so forth. So what we want to do is we want to focus on getting them into compliance. And it has to start at the local level because getting it done at the state level is untenable. There's too little representation. In other words, I don't know how many people that live in the average county. If I remember correctly, it's less than 50,000. If I remember correctly, the average county. When we go through the high numbered counties and so forth. The majority of the counties are less than 50,000. It's like 1,800 counties, something like that. So anyway, what that means, folks, is if you have three supervisors, then you have one person for less than 1 person representing less than 20,000 people. Now, welcome back, Sean. Does that make sense, Sean?
Yes, sir.
So that means that there's even more counties out there that have less than 50,000, which means that you even have better representation, which means that you actually, they should know you. There's a good chance that, they may not like you when you're holding them accountable. But folks, you have the ability, because of that kind of representation, to get in these guys' grills and hold them accountable, and if not, replacing them. These are not large campaigns. As a matter of fact, as I looked at Wyoming, the average state legislator race was less than 10,000. And I mean, that was in the last race. The very first race was less than 5,000 in 2018. And it's due to inflation. And because people started really playing the game of, okay, we're going to start buying these races, even in Wyoming. But still, that's not a lot of money. And I'm telling you, if you've got the right message, it doesn't matter how much money the other people are spending, especially if you're speaking to the core principles of the people that you're going to represent. Doesn't matter how much money they come up with. So as we kind of, peel the onion back on, taking this government back by using this standard or this demand of full compliance with the Constitution, getting it done at the county level is actually rather easy. And by doing that, then now we actually have the counties being able to, I want you to be, clear, we don't have county representation. So these county governments no longer, appoint or have any involvement in that state senate. But that doesn't mean that the counties, if you get a majority of your counties, that doesn't mean that they don't have the power. Because this is a democracy, constitutional republic. It's not a democratic form of government, but we do have, if we've got the numbers of counties, those counties can start driving the changes. They can start driving a constitutional convention and rewrite your state constitution. Doesn't matter who, you know, wrote your state constitution, because there are cases. And Tennessee came up in the in my interview on Monday, that Tennessee, as one of the early states, interestingly enough, and I've got to do the due diligence, because my guess is the reason why Tennessee marginalized the counties is because I believe that the counties could have easily overcome, number-wise, the control of the state and actually moved Tennessee from being a slave state, away from being a slave state. Now, just work with me on this. The first American franchise was slavery. I mean, even though tobacco was a managed production by the British Empire, because I don't think there were very many people that wanted to grow tobacco, but it was demanded by Britain that, you know, each of these plantations, each of these agricultural farms would have to produce so much. And tobacco was considered really a scourge because it just it depleted your soil. And you go, you know, you would think that if you were growing something that took such nutrients out of the soil, that would be something that would be very good for you, right? Wow, it's just got to be rich in all these good things. Not tobacco. So it's ironic that tobacco really became a scourge. It also became the cash crop, because it was that required, or the requirement was that heavily placed upon the states, or I should say the colonies, agricultural plantations and so forth. So anyway, only the plantations that had large slaves had the ability to kind of do, you know, a large enough, I'll just say, part of their property. Because let's say the requirement was every farm had to do 80% tobacco. Well, some of these smaller farms, they wouldn't have been able to do much, you know, for them, maybe enough just for themselves, where the plantations would be able to have a surplus because they had lots of land. They were buying and growing and buying and growing. And these large plantations continued to go and grow, and these franchises were getting pretty big. And they were all of the same family, or at least there was that kind of relationship between them. Because what happens when, you know, the young men of the household grow up, not all of them are going to inherit that, you know, the parents' plantation. If you have three or four sons, and if you have the affluence, then the father would go out and buy land and get them started on their plantation. And that's how it basically propagated across America into the southern states, where slavery was being maintained. So when Tennessee became a state, there weren't a lot of big, I mean, there were big plantations in there, but the majority of the land was still small farm. Does that make sense? Which means those small farms didn't have slaves, or they had barely any slaves. They weren't places where there were large populations of slaves. And so this is my supposition. When I heard that they took away the sovereignty of the counties, and that the counties were basically instituted by a charter. Now, just so you understand, folks, a charter is not a good thing. A charter is something that is being established by a higher authority. All of the states or the colonies, all of the colonies were created by a charter from the king. The king allowed this colony to be formed to do these very specific things. Now, everybody understands that when The pilgrims came across. They had a charter to be able to do some things. And the whole purpose they were coming for was religious freedom. Well, they didn't have all of the things that they wanted in, you know, their request to having this land under the king, under this charter. The king just said, well, I'll let you do these things, but you got to do these other things, which means that they were kind of happy that when they got here late, and anybody that knows the history of Massachusetts, the first thing the pilgrims did was they said, before they even landed, they go, because we're getting here so late in the year, this charter is no longer void. You know, it's no longer valid. And they created their own charter, and they went with the, I'll call them, there was the Puritans and the non-Puritans. And I forget there was a name for them, but they got these non-Puritans to go along with them. And so they instituted this different form of government, and they had a completely different charter. Well, so charters come from on high. In Tennessee, they basically said, we're going to establish or we're going to pull the county governments underneath the state as administrative bodies. And that's what the people wanted, or so you would think. That's what the affluent people wanted. This is very much like what played out in Missouri. Missouri required external intervention because they knew when they went into the convention, they would not have the same, help me out here, they would not have the same affluence and influence to ensure that they would become a slave state. Therefore, they got Congress to declare that they would be a slave state, all unconstitutional. So the point is that when we look at Tennessee, I believe that was one of the driving factors of why Tennessee was configured differently. Now, we've already covered on this show that we have these inalienable rights, and one of those rights is that we, the people, have the right to alter, abolish, or institute new governments. And if you don't believe your government is doing what it needs to do and you don't like the way the state's controlling your county government, you have a right to institute a new county government. Well, how do you do that? Any ideas, Sean?
I would say constitutional committees.
There you go. So it would all start by establishing at the county level a constitutional compliance committee, because you got to really get your arms around understanding, one, the U.S. Constitution, the state constitution, and so forth. Because once you start realizing, you know, how our rights fit into that and what, you know, can be done constitutionally, what can't be done constitutionally, you will start learning and realizing that you have a right to actually create a constitutional, or I should say, establish a constitutional convention for your county to basically form your county government and delegate powers to it. Now, the problem is that you can't necessarily do that and operate underneath the existing constitution. So what happens is you would be creating a shadow government, but you can create a constitution and basically put it on the shelf to say, if by chance we can get the state to either recognize that we want to have our own government, or we get enough counties to say we're taking back, you know, our right of governing and we're going to, you know, govern ourselves because we've already created our own constitutions, and then therefore we are going to have a new state constitution convention. Once that new state constitution is done, it will integrate the rights of the counties into that new constitution. So now you've constituted, you have to do it stepping stone, though. You have to start at the counties, you got to get a majority of all your counties to do this. And then you go in and you reform your state constitution to adapt it to this new hybrid republic so that each county becomes a republican form of government as well as the state. And so we're working on, like I said, we're working on a template. With the Mountain Patriots. So I'm working with them to, you know, get a template for a constitution so that everybody can go, okay, we start with this, you know, and then you got to remember, everything you want to add to that county. You're going to look at the county as doing some stuff, like your waste management, your water, those types of things. And so you're going to have to determine what is necessary and what isn't necessary and what will have to be done by each individual, because, you know, you won't get the people of the county to really want to do this unless it really becomes very favorable to them. And so there's going to have to be, there will be compromises. This, there's no doubt. In other words, let's say you look at your county and it's spending a lot of money on a sewage processing system that hardly anybody's using, but it's basically taking money out of everybody's property to cover that for this, you know, one town that wanted to have a sewage system, and the costs are just too high. Well, then that town is going to have to no longer be able to utilize that, or they're going to have to pay for it themselves. And or, because if it's managed by the state, you know, cheaper by the dozen. It's cheaper when you can, you know, share that load with everybody so that everybody pays. But it's not fair to everybody to pay for, you know, things that don't go to them. In other words, if I'm paying taxes, I should have, you know, the benefits of that, not basically paying welfare for somebody else to have a nicer life. So anyway, as you go through the process, you'll start realizing that there may be things like this that some people will actually may have to go, okay, either we pay for our own sewage, or we need to, you know, resurrect our what we call them, septic systems, and go back to septic systems, and or whatever. And this may actually, because right now the government has just been deciding to go down these paths, doesn't mean that the systems we're currently using are the most efficient and the best. And so what ends up happening is all of a sudden, when we realize that, you know, we have to pay for everything and we can't do it the way, you know, the status quo of just taking from others to do what we want to do, it forces innovation. And you'll find that even though it may seem like, oh, shoot, a septic system, I don't know if you know how much they cost in Louisiana, but installing a septic system for a home is somewhere around $30,000 to $50,000. And that's a huge cost. So there are other solutions. There are other things that you can probably, and I believe that, you know, necessity is the mother of invention, that we'll probably find better ways in the 21st century to, you know, manage, you know, waste from a home, you know, going in and filtering it into, you know, the earth or the environment, what have you. But anyway, long story short, is as you do these things, you're going to have to realize, well, we can't afford these things, so we're going to have to get rid of them. And now each individual is going to be strapped, and we're going to have to figure out what to do. Now, I'm going to just say this, that you can't force somebody, you know, you can't take all of the blood out of somebody so that you kill them just because your standards for their life is greater than what they can do for themselves. In other words, this nation didn't start off with, you know, demanding that every child had its own room. It's nice to have a housing standard that says all the children need to have, at least different sexes need to be in their own rooms. And or so the boys can be in one room, girls can be in one room, so those types of things. So we've created these standards for ourselves. But how was it back in the 1800s? Well, shoot, the average household was one big room. Everybody slept in the same room where they cooked, where they talked, where they entertained themselves. It was the family room. It was the family house, you know. And so I guess if you had more affluence, you'd create a different cabin for, you know, the kids, what have you. But it's amazing how we survived in those types of conditions. Regardless, right, wrong, or indifferent, when society can levy those types of standards to actually crush and destroy a family, I think we're going in the wrong direction. What do you think, Sean?
I agree. Just here in our area, we have, they're putting sidewalks along the main drag through town, and the people still walk in the street. So, yeah, it's pretty crazy. Yeah, the only people that walk along that area aren't going to walk on the sidewalks. And the last week we had rain all week, and every like 10 feet there's puddles covering the sidewalks. And my wife and I were talking about that. We're driving past going, who came up with this brilliant idea?
Yeah.
Because right on my own street, we have a chunk of sidewalk missing where they had to fix the sewer.
Uh-huh.
And they never came and replaced the sidewalk. But they're building sidewalks up there by the main road where you drive down the road and it's where all the grocery stores and, you know, businesses are. It's a main drag. And they're putting sidewalks, which is nice. You know, they want to create this homey town, you know, to, but it doesn't really serve a purpose because nobody really walks along that area. And when they do, they walk in the road. But I'm sure it had something to do with people getting struck by vehicles on the road. That's happened several times in this area. So I think that might have had something to do with it. But at the same time, what I'd like to know is whose company is making the money off of building those sidewalks, and why aren't they fixing the sidewalks in the neighborhoods where people actually walk?
Let me ask you this, because I've heard this, and this has got really nothing to do with what we're talking about, but I've heard this term called the neutral ground. Have you heard that?
Oh, absolutely. I know the story of it. But too, they had the French section and an American section down in the city.
Okay.
They had the French Quarter, and then to the west of that was where the Americans started building up. And Canal Street was a really wide street because they used to have a canal, and they filled it in, and they built the streets, and there's like probably about a 30-foot stretch between the two sides of the road. And so you had French on one side and American, and then like when they had markets, that would be the neutral ground
where,
you know, they interacted, and that caught on and continued to be used. So that's what we call our medians, neutral grounds.
Okay.
That's
so
where you park your car when the parade's coming or when it floods, and then you set up your tent on there when it's parade time.
Okay. So what I had heard, and the way it, to me, was this neutral ground was kind of in the middle median of the road. In other words, you had roads, the cars passing one way, one direction of traffic would be going in, you know, a road, and then there would be the neutral ground, or what we would call a median.
Right.
And then a little bit further away would be the opposing traffic coming in the opposite direction. And so the neutral ground was where these little, you know, shops or these little bodegas and what have you, kiosks, whatever you wanted to call these things, where people could do transactions, business, so forth, buy, you know, pretzels. Anyway.
Well, no, not really specifically that. It was more that it was neutral ground between the two sections of the city.
Okay.
Because there was a canal there, and then they filled the canal in and started building it up as a commercial area.
Okay.
Where they had stores on each side. So they had a road on one side of the canal and a road on the other side of the canal. And then they filled in the canal, and it was a big open area, which is a median. But since it was French and American on either side that had built up, then they called it the neutral ground between the two.
It wasn't...
You know, it didn't belong to anybody at first.
Yeah, okay.
And then when they filled in the canal,
then
it was an open area that wasn't on one side or the other.
All right, we're out of time.
A lot of things like that in our city where it's just this little section is this heritage and this section is that heritage.
Here we go. We're out of time. So when we come back, I'll ask you more about it because I'd actually heard that this neutral ground was applied during Mardi Gras and other places where they'd had parades so that these shops could set up. They called it the neutral ground, I guess, during that time. Because I don't know. But it was just kind of interesting because I always thought, wow, okay, that a median? But that really has nothing to do with the content in South Carolina. We'll be right back after this.
My show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.
As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416. So sorry for going down this rat hole, but I had heard from people who used to live in New Orleans that kind of referred to the neutral ground as, you know, during the parades of Mardi Gras or other parades, funerals, what have you, that there would be the neutral ground on these different streets, not just that. So anyway, and I go, huh, that's interesting. You mean a median? And no, that's neutral ground.
Anyway. Right. That's where it comes from there. Now the streetcar runs on it. So
okay. Yeah, okay. So the streetcars, because the streetcars go in different directions, so that's all called the neutral ground now.
Correct.
Okay. All right. Thank you for the clarity on that. And so forgive me, folks, for digressing. But the point is that we have the ability to take back the state government by using the county. Because, folks, that county government's not yours. Even though you have representation in it, you've never claimed it. You've never instituted your county government. And this is why I tell you, this is a right. This is an irrefutable right. We, the people, have a right to institute governments. If they're not meeting our needs, we have a right to alter, abolish, or institute anew. And I'm not telling you to abolish or alter. I'm telling you to institute your government for first and finally to get it done, because it was never done. Which is why this shroud of, how come we have these representatives, but they don't work for us? Why is it that the county, the state and bureaucrats and the federal government is coming in and telling them what to do, and they don't listen to us, but we vote for them, and they represent us, supposedly? What the heck? Are you starting to get it? Because we failed to do our job, they're getting away with murder. Anyway, any comments on that before we move into the South Carolina debates?
Well, I did want to ask you, and this has been gnawing at me, it's the 250th anniversary coming up,
yep,
of the Declaration of Independence.
Correct.
What is your, what do you see as the Declaration of Independence as? Is that the founding of our nation, and the Constitution was developed from that? So is that considered a legal document when it comes to our government and our rights?
So I'll use the term epoch. The Declaration of Independence was the epoch of this new experiment. And we took from at that point in time, with that epoch, they formed a government as a part of that, that just impotent and inept, Articles of Confederation. And so one could say that the Constitution itself was the second epoch, because it truly instituted a whole new government, but it was that, but technically, The Constitution itself was built upon those principles of the Declaration. The Declaration of Independence, as many people say, it was our governing document. It was not. That's why they were operating, when they wrote the Declaration of Independence, the governing document was the Articles of Association. In other words, the sovereign states, at that point in time, the colonies, decided that they were going to organize to a degree to create a general government to serve the Confederation. And that general government was very limited, and it was only going to do these very few things of economic sanctions and so forth, so that England would recognize that, you know, we have these fundamental rights, and that they would finally recognize us and bring us into the fold so that we would have equality and equal standing as those folks and those counties in England, that these states, you know, would actually become kind of integrated in an equal status, equal footing. Well, that didn't happen. And again, the biggest, stupidest business decision ever made in the face of the earth was not to actually integrate these states. Because I still stand that that was the worst business decision ever by King George. So King George decided that he was going to say, nope, you're our subjects and we're going to treat you like subjects. And realizing that we had more people in these states than they had in England, in the entire UK. We had grown to that degree. And there was just no way they could project the force necessary to come and occupy us and control us, which is why we were able to get away with what we were doing. So as the Declaration of Independence was created under the auspices of the Articles of Association, what it did was it forced the states to actually go back to the drawing board and say, okay, the byproduct of the Articles of Association moved us into independent states instead of colonies. Therefore, we need to change that, the governing document of the Articles of Association, into the Articles of Confederation, which is why it was written in the following year in 1877, in creating and empowering Continental Congress to be able to do far more than what Articles of Association empowered them to do, so that we would have a government that could serve the independent states instead of the colonies trying to get its recognition of its rights. Does that make sense? So it was kind of evolutionary.
Right.
Okay, so, but the Declaration of Independence truly was that point where we said, that's it, we're severing ties. It was a declaration. We're severing ties, but it identified some very specific principles. In other words, these inalienable rights that we, the people, have a right to institute our government. And so we are no longer going to recognize the tyranny of Britain, you know, and allow them to institute government for us, that we're going to start instituting our own government. And that's exactly what we started doing. Well, we did that with the federal government. And supposedly, we kind of did that with our state government, but government is government. And it's right there in the Declaration of Independence that governments are instituted by men, that we have the right to institute them when they don't serve us. We just failed to institute all of our governments. And we allowed a system that would create charters for cities and charters for counties and charters, which means that we weren't instituting them. We were being allowed to have a government. In other words, we had completely forgotten, and I excuse the expression, but, you know, over the years, there have been so many people peeing in our gene pool that we completely lost those principles. We no longer had, you know, what our forefathers had, the want and the demand of having control over our government. We were happy with allowing government to control us. What the heck happened? Peeing in our gene pool. So now people are starting.
Do you think it was that, or do you think it was more? What always comes to my mind when I think about this is why someone would ever do such a thing. Once you get supposed, quote, air quote, red-pilled, and you understand individual liberty, and I think this comes from Scripture and understanding our liberty in Christ, is the comfort level. We are so prosperous, and the standard of living became so high that we really, everybody was doing business, and you know, not everybody was having a great life, but the people who weren't profiting from the industry and the economy were trying to struggle to, you know, scratch out a living, like pioneer people and people on the fringes that were, you know, they don't have time to worry about the government because they're trying to grow food to feed their family and do those sorts of things. So
right. So Ronald Reagan had a common saying, and I forget exactly what it was. Anybody can Google it. That liberty, the loss of liberty, can be done in one generation. That if we're not vigilant, then we will lose our liberty. And so that's the thing. Our government is, and we don't, we stopped operating a self-governing system because, one, we were just, you're right. We did, you know, we weren't happy with the compromises, but, you know, we weren't losing that much. Every time a compromise came along, we lost a little bit more. Now, in contrast, if you look over time of what we were losing under England with the taxes and so forth, and what we have lost today by just being complacent, we're far more subjugated today than our forefathers were.
Oh, absolutely.
And so why is it? You know, is it because, you know, we've got Circus Maximus? Is it because, you know, that old saying with Rome, if you keep the people entertained, you can get away with murder? You know, there may be
that plays a big part in it.
Yeah.
I think it's also the godlessness that's been wreaked upon the country.
Yes.
And it comes back to that. And it's the same thing as in those days, but it wasn't on so much of a scale. Because you had, I'm sure you had wicked, godless people at that time, and who cared more about their own profit and benefit, you know, like we have today, the so-called Christians, where they go to church and they believe in this and they believe in that, but it's really about their money and their 401k and everything like that. I mean, you can't blame people for that. You have to live in reality, but I'm just talking about the spiritual warfare against human nature. And it's gotten to such a scale now, and it's been so indoctrinated into the system that we've allowed by our complacence to be built and our government to be captured that, you know, it's hard to fight back against it because it has so much power now.
Yeah, so it's interesting how history repeats itself. All of these things have kind of been gone through. I mean, over a very incredibly long course, because in Aristotle's Politics, he talks about what it takes for people to finally revolt against their government. Because, you know, Aristotle was the mentor for Alexander the Great. And Alexander the Great was asking all of these different questions, like, why is it that, you know, the people, you know, have this propensity to always, you know, create a government that becomes a statist government or becomes so controlling? Well, Aristotle's response to that was that people love their families. All societies are built, the nucleus of all societies are built by the family. And so as people kind of change, and the cultures of the families do change, which changes that form of government, by the way. But what they do is they try to implement a family architecture in their government. In other words, a nanny state. Statist government. They actually start trying, government starts to try to take care of them. And as government starts realizing, I'm taking care of these people, now I can control these people by the way I'm taking care of them. And that's how it always happens. And so, but the point in politics of what Aristotle is basically making, as far as when people finally realize that they got to revolt against their government, There are two points. When people are starving, they will revolt. When they can't eat and their survival is on the line, they will start doing things that they never, you know, they would never have thought of earlier, but until their bellies and the pain of starvation is set in. The other time when people will wake up is just that. They wake up because government is now doing things that is making themselves rich at the expense of the governed. And so when people start waking up, that you know, they're doing this, like these death panels. The death panels that are starting to form, that are deciding that there's no money in maintaining your health anymore. I've personally seen this happen just this past couple months, where a death panel basically told a young man he was going to die. There's no way we can help you. Your health is that bad. We're just pulling the plug because it's just not, there's no return on the investment. So people are waking up. People are realizing that the problem is there's this misplaced hope that these people that they think can actually do something for them is going to do something for them, when it is antithetical for anybody to do anything like that. One truism is government is never going to cut off its arm to help you. It may change its circumstances so you perceive that you're better off, but you are still under their control. They will never let go that control. They will never let go of what they have worked hard to obtain in controlling us. So when we say, oh, well, look at, you know, Trump is the perfect example. He's the now, oh, well, we can trust government now. He doesn't even have the authority to do these things. We have to do these things. This is why I say that only the states can get the federal government into the condition that it needs to be in to put it back on track. Only the states can do that. He can't do it. He has no constitutional authority to do it. Congress doesn't have the constitutional authority to do it. Only the states. And Congress is not going to do it, by the way, nor will the president do it, nor will the Supreme Court do it. It's almost like amputating a perfectly good arm. It's still working. It's still functioning. You know, yeah, we see that the people aren't happy with it. It's only by force when arms and appendages get amputated. So people have to wake up, and they actually have to start dismantling these vestiges of tyranny. Answer your question? But right, there are
absolutely
there are lots of factors involved in all of this. There are lots of factors. Yeah. I mean, one person can easily, you know, just try to point one key thing. And whether it's the biggest thing or not, it may be a key thing. You know, it's easy to marginalize. But I will say, when you start understanding the process of starting at the county level, and the ease of doing this, because again, I'm going to go back to what I said. As a matter of fact, too often I do this, and I'm going to do it because it is, you know, it's worthwhile. I'm going to actually pull up, because I have the latest census spreadsheet. And so let me pull up that census spreadsheet so that we can look at what the counties really are. And so let me see your references, spreadsheets right there. Okay. County populations. All right. So if I go by population, the base population, largest to smallest, when we get down to 50,000 population of a county, in other words, 50,000 or less. So I'm actually going down to 49,971. That means that there are, and I'm going to just go all the way to the end. The easiest way to do this is just let it run. Let it run, and it's going to take a while. But if I'm at 1,042 from the top to bottom, and there's 3,000 counties, then the numbers are going to probably come in the 2,000s, folks. That's my guess. It's going to be about 2,000. So what that means is if we got 2,000 counties with less than 50,000 people, and the average county always has three, they're never going to have two and they won't have one. Why? Because they want a tiebreaker. If you have two, then, you know, you need a tiebreaker, so you have to have a third. If you only have one, then, you know, you've got a little despot because that's a dictator. So the total is 2,152 counties that have 50,000 or less. That means that's a lot of counties in the United States, and if we started adding these, and if I highlighted all of these counties right now, and then I went through and added up out of each of the states, we would probably find that would be almost a majority of the counties in a state, almost, because it is a majority of the United States, right? There's 3,000, it's two-thirds of the entire United States. Now, you may have some states that, you know, because it's a small state and it's kind of populated. I'll give you a good example. Delaware might be one of those states that the counties will be kind of high population just because of the small land mass and the high density of population on the eastern seaboard. That makes sense, right?
Yes, sir.
So when we look at Wyoming, though, we're going to probably find that not one Wyoming county comes even close to 50,000. Maybe only one or two. Here's the question. Why aren't we taking back our counties? It's the easiest strategic target for us. And it's actually, you know, there's so many reasons why this is where we need to focus. Because we never took ownership of our government. And we have a right to do that. This is so simple. This is so factual. This is so basic that I have a hard time. I mean, I deal with people all the time that try to argue against it, but, you know, it ultimately comes down to they're just deniers. You know what I'm saying? They will just refuse. And it's kind of like that biblical scripture that they say, well, okay, but I'm just telling you that the moon is sure bright tonight when it's actually it's daytime and that's the sun. They're just denying that it's daytime and that's the sun. They're just saying, well, no, it's nighttime. It's just that the moon's really bright. So anywho.
Madness.
Yeah, it is. Let's dive into the South Carolina debate. We've stopped off, and this is still the Honorable Charles Cotesworth Pinckney. And he's now talking about the importance and the purpose of bicameral legislation. Go ahead.
The purpose of establishing different houses of legislation was to introduce the influence of different interests and principles, and he thought that we should derive from this mode of separating the legislature into two branches. Those benefits which a proper complication of principles is capable of producing, and which must, in his judgment, be greater than any evils that may arise from their temporary dissensions. The judicial he conceived to be at once the most important and intricate part of the system, that a supreme federal jurisdiction was indispensable, cannot be denied. It is equally true that in order to ensure the administration of justice, it was necessary to give it all the powers, original as well as appellate, the Constitution has enumerated. Without it, we could not expect a due observance of treaties, that the state judiciary would confine themselves within their proper sphere, or that general sense of justice pervade the Union, which this part of this Constitution is intended to introduce and protect. That much, however, would depend upon the wisdom of the legislatures who are to organize it, that from the extensiveness of its powers, it may be easily seen that, under a wise management, this department might be made the keystone of the arch, the proceedings of the Union, that in republics, much more in time of peace, would always depend upon the energy and integrity of the judicial than on any other part of the government, that to ensure these, extensive authorities were necessary, particularly so were they in a tribunal consisted as this is, whose duty it would be not only to decide all national questions which should arise within the Union, but to control and keep the state judicials within their proper limits whenever they shall attempt to interfere with its power.
Okay, so let me interrupt right there, because the one point that we want to make clear is arising under the Constitution, and the way he framed it was with the words should arise within the Union. And so he also talks about this, the proper power over those powers that are original, as well as appeal it up at the very top. He's talking equally about those powers given to them. In other words, I wish he would have been a little bit more clearer in stating. So you got to remember that this is an original oration. There's probably going to be a likelihood that some of the anti-federalists will hear how he just kind of was generalizing, which would cause fear and or concern and alarm. Hold on here. What you just said is this judiciary is going to be really powerful. Well, okay, they're really powerful when it comes to those things delegated to the government. They have the authority to establish those national standards on those things, like treaties. And that's what he used as an example, not about common law. Right? Because we already know the common law was deployed differently. And so when those things start popping up, now they start differentiating because hold on here. What about our right to a trial by jury? Almost every state complained about that, which is one of the reasons why they had to clarify and clarify. And then ultimately the states were still so, I'll just say they were so suspicious of the federal government and based on how the courts were acting already out the gate. The states demanded the 11th Amendment. And it was in 1796. Less than 10 years later, they said, you know what? We're done with this federal court system. We're done with this. We want these powers between the states and a person of another state and between foreigners of a state and so forth. No way. If it's not arising under the Constitution, you can't meddle with them anymore. And that's why the 11th Amendment was, basically submitted and ratified. So, go ahead. Keep going. Oh, hold on.
And the
Hold on. I just realized.
Yeah, we're about to run out of
time. You know, I know you can read pretty quickly, but I don't think you could do that in 20 seconds. So, anyway. Any go-backs or anything else? Because we just didn't cover that much today, but we'll get more tomorrow.
No, I was just wondering, was there a specific event or issue that happened that arose to the or caused the 11th Amendment, like you were talking about? Was that the Alien and Sedition Acts?
No. That was before the Alien and Sedition Acts. And yeah, okay. There were some specific events that actually were happening between the states. And if you go, I think if you look at Wikipedia, it might talk about a couple of those events that happened with state judiciaries or cases that got pulled in under the auspices of the jurisdiction between a state and a person of another state and so forth, where the states go, are you kidding me? So they basically came back and said, no way, no how. And they wiped out that jurisdiction away from the federal court. Now, again, the Congress has the responsibility of regulating the courts. They're not independent. Anyway, with that, folks, we'll get back into this tomorrow. I'm G.R. Mobley with Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.